This complex of machine intelligence is trained to isolate, capture, and render the most subtle and intimate behaviors, from an inadvertent blink to a jaw that slackens in surprise for a fraction of a second. Combinations of sensors and software can recognize and identify faces, estimate age, ethnicity, and gender, analyze gaze direction and blinks, and track distant facial points to interpret micro-expressions, eye movements, emotions, moods, stress, deceit, boredom, confusion, intentions, and more, all at the speed of life. As the SEWA project description says, technologies that can robustly and accurately analyze human facial, vocal, and verbal behavior and interactions in the wild, as observed by omnipresent webcams in digital devices, would have profound impact on both basic sciences and the industrial sector. They measure behavior indicators that heretofore resisted measurement because they were too subtle or fleeting to be measured by the human eye and ear. These behaviors also elude the conscious mind. The machines capture the nanosecond of disgust that precedes a rapid-fire sequence of anger, comprehension, and finally joy on the face of a young woman watching a few frames of film, when all she can think to say is, "I liked it." A Realize white paper explains that its webcams record people watching videos in their homes so we can capture genuine reactions. Algorithms process facial expressions, and emotions are detected, aggregated, and reported online in real time, second by second, enabling our clients to make better business decisions. Realize emphasizes its own proprietary metrics to help marketers target audiences and predict performance. Once again, a key theme of machine intelligence is that quality is a function of quantity. Realize says that its datasets contain over 5.5 million individually annotated frames of more than 7,000 subjects from all over the world. We are continuously working to build the world's largest expression and behavior datasets by increasing the quality and volume of our already existing categories and by creating new sets for other expressions, emotions, different behavioral clues, or different intensities. Having automated this process, it can then be scaled up to simultaneously track the emotions of entire audiences. Clients are advised to play your audience emotions to stay on top of the game. The company's website offers a brief review of the history of research on human emotions, concluding that the more people feel, the more they spend. Intangible emotions translate into concrete social activity, brand awareness, and profit. The chair of SEWA's industry advisory board is frank about this undertaking, observing that unlocking the meaning of the non-spoken language of the whole body and interpreting complex emotional response will be wonderful for interpreting reactions to marketing materials, adding that it is simply foolish not to take emotional response into account when evaluating all marketing materials. Indeed, these non-conscious tools extract rarefied new qualities of behavioral surplus from your inner life in order to predict what you will buy and the precise moment at which you are most vulnerable to a push. SEWA's advisory chair says that emotional analytics are like identifying individual musical notes. Each potential customer, then, is a brief and knowable composition. We will be able to identify chords of human response, such as liking, boredom, etc. We will ultimately become masters of reading each other's feelings and intent. This is not the first time that the unconscious mind has been targeted as an instrument of others' aims. Propaganda and advertising have always been designed to appeal to unacknowledged fears and yearnings. These have relied more on art than science, using gross data or professional intuition for the purpose of mass communication. Those operations cannot be compared to the scientific application of today's historic computational power to the micro-measured, continuous rendition of your more or less actual feelings. The new toolmakers do not intend to rob you of your inner life, only to surveil and exploit it. All they ask is to know more about you than you know about yourself. Although the treasures of the unconscious mind have been construed differently across the millennia, from spirit to soul to self, the ancient priest and the modern psychotherapist are united in an age-old reverence for its primal healing power through self-discovery, self-mastery, integration, restoration, and transcendence. In contrast, the conception of emotions as observable behavioral data first took root in the mid-1960s with the work of Paul Ekman, then a young professor at the University of California, San Francisco. From his earliest papers, Ekman argued that actions speak louder than words. Even when a person is determined to censor or control his or her emotional communications, Ekman postulated that some types of nonverbal behaviors escape control and provide leakage. Early on, he recognized the potential utility of a categorical scheme that reliably traced the effects of expression back to their causes in emotion. And in 1978, Ekman, along with frequent collaborator Wallace Friesen, published the seminal facial action coding system, FACS, which provided that scheme. FACS distinguishes the elemental movements of facial muscles, breaking them down into 27 facial action units, along with more for the head, eyes, tongue, and so on. Later, Ekman concluded that 6 basic emotions, anger, fear, sadness, enjoyment, disgust, and surprise, anchored the wider array of human emotional expression. FACS and the 6 emotion model became the dominant paradigm for the study of facial expression and emotion, in much the same way that the 5-factor model came to dominate studies of personality. The program of emotional rendition began innocently enough with MIT Media Lab professor Rosalind Picard and the new field of computer science that she called affective computing. She was among the first to recognize the opportunity for a computational system to automate the analysis of Ekman's facial configurations and correlate micro-expressions with their emotional causality. She aimed to combine facial expression with the computation of vocal intonation and other physiological signals of emotion that could be measured as behavior. In 1997, she published Affective Computing, which posited a practical solution to the idea that some emotions are available to the conscious mind and can be expressed cognitively. I feel scared. Whereas others may elude consciousness, but nevertheless be expressed physically in beads of sweat, a widening of the eyes, or a nearly imperceptible tightening of the jaw. The key to effective computing, Picard argued, was to render both conscious and unconscious emotion as observable behavior for coding and calculation. A computer, she reasoned, would be able to render your emotions as behavioral information. Affect recognition, as she put it, is a pattern recognition problem, and affect expression is pattern synthesis. The proposition was that computers can be given the ability to recognize emotions as well as a third-person human observer. Picard imagined her effective insights being put to use in ways that were often good-hearted or, at the very least, benign. Most of the applications, she describes, conform to the logic of the aware home. Any knowledge produced would belong to the subject to enhance his or her reflexive learning. For example, she envisioned a computer interviewing agent that could function as an effective mirror, coaching a student in preparation for a job interview or a date, and an automatic agent that could alert you to hostile tones in your own prose before you press send. Picard anticipated other tools combining software and sensors that she believed could enhance daily life in a range of situations, such as helping autistic children develop emotional skills, providing software designers with feedback on users' frustration levels, assigning points to video game players to reward courage or stress reduction, producing learning modules that stimulate curiosity and minimize anxiety, and analyzing emotional dynamics in a classroom. She imagined software agents that learn your preferences and find you the kinds of news stories, clothing, art, or music that make you smile. Whatever one's reaction to these ideas might be, they share one key pattern. Unlike Seva's model, Picard's data were intended to be for you, not merely about you. Back in 1997, Picard acknowledged the need for privacy so that you remain in control over who gets access to this information. Importantly for our analysis, in the final pages of her book, she expressed some concerns, writing that there are good reasons not to broadcast your affective patterns to the world. You might flaunt your good mood in front of friends. You probably do not want it picked up by an army of salespeople who are eager to exploit mood-based buying habits, or by advertisers eager to convince you that you'd feel better if you tried their new soft drink right now. She noted the possibility of intrusive workplace monitoring, and she voiced reservations about the possibility of a dystopian future in which malevolent governmental forces use affective computing to manipulate and control the emotions of populations. Despite these few paragraphs of apprehension, her conclusions were bland. "Every technology arrives with its pros and cons," she wrote. "The concerns are not insurmountable because safeguards can be developed." Picard was confident that technologies and techniques could solve any problem, and she imagined wearable computers that gather information strictly for your own use. She stressed the importance of ensuring that the wearer retains ultimate control over the devices he chooses to wear, so that they are tools of helpful empowerment and not of harmful subjugation. In a pattern that is by now all too familiar, safeguards lagged as surveillance capitalism flourished. By early 2014, Facebook had already applied for an emotion detection patent designed to implement each of Picard's fears. The idea was one or more software modules capable of detecting emotions, expressions, or other characteristic of a user from image information. As always, the company was ambitious. Its list of detectable emotions, by way of example and not limitation, included expressions such as a smile, joy, humor, amazement, excitement, surprise, a frown, sadness, disappointment, confusion, jealousy, indifference, boredom, anger, depression, or pain. The hope was that, over time, their module would be able to assess a user's interest in displayed content for the purposes of customization based on emotion type. By 2017, exactly 20 years after the publication of Picard's book, a leading market research firm forecast that the affective computing market, including software that recognizes speech, gesture, and facial expressions, along with sensors, cameras, storage devices, and processors, would grow from $9.35 billion in 2015 to $53.98 billion in 2021, predicting a compounded annual growth rate of nearly 35%. What happened to cause this explosion? The report concludes that heading up the list of triggers for this dramatic growth is rising demand for mapping human emotions, especially by the marketing and advertising sector. Picard's good intentions were like so many innocent iron filings in the presence of a magnet, as the market demand exerted by the prediction imperative drew affective computing into surveillance capitalism's powerful force field. Picard would eventually become part of this new dispossession industry with a company called Affectiva that was co-founded with Rana El-Kalyubi, an MIT Media Lab postdoctoral research scientist and Picard protégé. The company's transformation from doing good to doing surveillance capitalism is a metaphor for the fate of the larger undertaking of emotion analysis, as it is rapidly drawn into the competitive maelstrom for surveillance revenues. Both Picard and Kalyubi had shared a vision of applying their research in medical and therapeutic settings. The challenges of autistic children seemed a perfect fit for their discoveries, so they trained a machine system called Mind Reader to recognize emotions using paid actors to mimic specific emotional responses and facial gestures. Early on, MIT Media Lab corporate sponsors, Pepsi, Microsoft, Bank of America, Nokia, Toyota, Procter & Gamble, Gillette, Unilever, and others, had overwhelmed the pair with queries about using their system to measure customers' emotional responses. Kalyubi describes the women's hesitation and their determination to focus on do-good applications. According to her account, the Media Lab encouraged the two women to spin off their work into the startup they called Affectiva, imagined as a baby IBM for emotionally intelligent machines. It wasn't long before the new company found itself fielding significant interest from ad agencies and marketing firms, itching for automated rendition and analysis from the depths. Describing that time, as Picard told one journalist, "Our CEO was absolutely not comfortable with the medical space." As a result, Picard was pushed out of the firm 3 years after its founding. As an Affectiva researcher recounted, "We began with a powerful set of products that could assist people who have a very difficult time with perceiving affect. Then they started to emphasize only the face, to focus on advertisements and on predicting whether someone likes a product, and just went totally off the original mission." Companies such as market research firm Millward Brown and advertising powerhouse McCann Erickson, competing in a new world of targeted, personalized ads, already craved access to the inarticulate depths of the consumer response. Millward Brown had even formed a neuroscience unit, but found it impossible to scale. It was Affectiva's analysis of one particularly nuanced ad for Millward Brown that dazzled its executives and decisively turned the tide for the startup. "The software was telling us something we were potentially not seeing," one Millward Brown executive said. "People often can't articulate such detail in 60 seconds. By 2016, Kalyubi was the company's CEO, redefining its business as Emotion AI and calling it the next frontier of artificial intelligence. The company had raised $34 million in venture capital, included 32 Fortune 100 companies and 1,400 brands from all over the world among its clients, and claimed to have the largest repository of emotion data in the world, with 4.8 million face videos from 75 countries, even as it continued to expand its supply routes with data sourced from online viewing, video game participation, driving, and conversation. This is the commercial context in which Kalyubi came to feel that it is perfectly reasonable to assert that an emotion chip will become the base operational unit of a new emotion economy. She speaks to her audiences of a chip embedded in all things everywhere, running constantly in the background, producing an emotion pulse each time you check your phone. "I think in the future we'll assume that every device just knows how to read your emotions." At least one company, EmoShape, has taken her proposition seriously. The firm, whose tagline is "Life is the value," produces a microchip that it calls the industry's first emotion synthesis engine, delivering high-performance machine emotion awareness. The company writes that its chip can classify 12 emotions with up to 98% accuracy, enabling its artificial intelligence or robot to experience 64 trillion possible distinct emotional states. Kalyubi imagines that pervasive emotion scanning will come to be as taken for granted as a cookie planted in your computer to track your online browsing. After all, Those cookies once stirred outrage, and now they inundate every online move. For example, she anticipates YouTube scanning its viewers' emotions as they watch videos. Her confidence is buoyed by demand that originates in the prediction imperative. The way I see it, it doesn't matter that your Fitbit doesn't have a camera, because your phone does, and your laptop does, and your TV will. All that data gets fused with biometrics from your wearable devices and builds an emotional profile for you. As a start, Affectiva pioneered the notion of emotion as a service, offering its analytics on demand. Just record people expressing emotion and then send those videos or images to us to get powerful emotion metrics back. The possibilities in the depth dimension seem endless, and perhaps they will be if Affectiva, its clients, and fellow travelers are free to plunder ourselves at will. There are indications of more far-reaching ambitions in which emotion as a service expands from observation to modification. Happiness as a service seems to be within reach. I do believe that if we have information about your emotional experiences, we can help you be in a positive mood, Kalyubi says. She imagines emotion recognition systems issuing reward points for happiness because, after all, happy customers are more engaged. 4. When they come from my truth. Rendition is by now a global project of surveillance capital, and in the depth dimension, we see it at its most pernicious. Intimate territories of the self, like personality and emotion, are claimed as observable behavior and coveted for their rich deposits of predictive surplus. Now the personal boundaries that shelter inner life are officially designated as bad for business by a new breed of mercenaries of the self-determined to parse and package inner life for the sake of surveillance revenues. Their expertise disrupts the very notion of the autonomous individual by rewarding boundarylessness with whatever means are available. Offers of elite status, bonuses, happiness points, discounts, buy buttons pushed to your device at the precise moment predicted for maximum success, so that we might strip and surrender to the pawing and prying of the machines that serve the new market cosmos. I want to deliberately sidestep a more detailed discussion of what is personality or emotion, conscious or unconscious, in favor of what I hope is a less fractious truth thrown into relief by this latest phase of incursion. Experience is not what is given to me, but rather what I make of it. The same experience that I deride may invite your enthusiasm. The self is the inward space of lived experience from which such meanings are created. In that creation, I stand on the foundation of personal freedom. The foundation because I cannot live without making sense of my experience. No matter how much is taken from me, this inward freedom to create meaning remains my ultimate sanctuary. Jean-Paul Sartre writes that freedom is nothing but the existence of our will. And he elaborates, actually, it is not enough to will. It is necessary to will to will. This rising up of the will to will is the inner act that secures us as autonomous beings who project choice into the world and exercise the qualities of self-determining moral judgment that are civilization's necessary and final bulwark. This is the sense behind another of Sartre's insights. Without bearings, stirred by a nameless anguish, the words labor. The voice is born of a risk, either to lose oneself or win the right to speak in the first person. As the prediction imperative drives deeper into the self, the value of its surplus becomes irresistible, and cornering operations escalate. What happens to the right to speak in the first person, from and as myself, when the swelling frenzy of institutionalization set into motion by the prediction imperative is trained on cornering my size, blinks, and utterances on the way to my very thoughts as a means to others' ends. It is no longer a matter of surveillance capital, wringing surplus from what I search, buy, and browse. Surveillance capital wants more than my body's coordinates in time and space. Now, it violates the inner sanctum as machines and their algorithms decide the meaning of my breath and my eyes, my jaw muscles, the hitch in my voice, and the exclamation points that I offered in innocence and hope. What happens to my will to will myself into the first person when the surrounding market cosmos disguises itself as my mirror, shape-shifting according to what it has decided I feel or felt or will feel, ignoring, goading, chiding, cheering, or punishing me? Surveillance capital cannot keep from wanting all of me as deep and far as it can go. One firm that specializes in human analytics and effective computing has this headline for its marketing customers: "Get closer to the truth. Understand the why." What happens when they come for my truth, uninvited and determined to march through myself, taking the bits and pieces that can nourish their machines to reach their objectives? Cornered in myself, there is no escape. It appears that questions like these may have come to trouble Picard. In a 2016 lecture she gave in Germany titled "Towards Machines That Deny Their Maker," the bland assertions of her 1997 book that safeguards can be developed, that additional technologies and techniques could solve any problem, and that wearable computers would gather information strictly for your own use as tools of helpful empowerment and not of harmful subjugation, had given way to new reflections. Some organizations want to sense human emotions without people knowing or consenting, she said. A few scientists want to build computers that are vastly superior to humans, capable of powers beyond reproducing their own kind. How might we make sure that new effective technologies make human lives better? Picard did not foresee the market forces that would transform the rendition of emotion into for-profit surplus, means to others' ends. That her vision is made manifest in thousands of activities should be a triumph, but it is diminished by the fact that so many of those activities are now bound to the commercial surveillance project. Each failure to establish bearings contributes to habituation, normalization, and ultimately legitimation. Subordinated to the larger aims of surveillance capitalism, the thrust of the effective project changed as if distorted in a funhouse mirror. This cycle calls to mind the words of another MIT professor, the computer scientist and humanist Joseph Weizenbaum, who spoke eloquently and often on the inadvertent collusion of computer scientists in the construction of terrifying weapons systems. I believe he would have shaken his spear in the direction of today's sometimes unwitting and sometimes intentional mercenaries of the self, and it is fitting to conclude here with his voice. I don't quite know whether it is especially computer science or its sub-discipline, artificial intelligence, that has such an enormous affection for euphemism. We speak so spectacularly and so readily of computer systems that understand, that see, decide, make judgments, without ourselves recognizing our own superficiality and immeasurable naivete with respect to these concepts. And in the process of so speaking, we anesthetize our ability to become conscious of its end use. One can't escape this state without asking again and again, what do I actually do? What is the final application and use of the products of my work? And ultimately, am I content or ashamed to have contributed to this use? Chapter 10. Make them dance. But hear the morning's injured weeping and know why. Ramparts and souls have fallen. The will of the unjust has never lacked an engine. Still, all princes must employ the fairly noble unifying lie. W. H. Auden, Sonnets from China, 11. 1. Economies of Action. The new power is action, a senior software engineer told me. The intelligence of the Internet of Things means that sensors can also be actuators. The director of the software engineering for a company that is an important player in the Internet of Things added, "It's no longer simply about ubiquitous computing. Now the real aim is ubiquitous intervention, action, and control. The real power is that now you can modify real-time actions in the real world. Connected smart sensors can register and analyze any kind of behavior, and then actually figure out how to change it. Real-time analytics translate into real-time action." The scientists and engineers I interviewed call this new capability actuation, and they describe it as the critical, though largely undiscussed, turning point in the evolution of the apparatus of ubiquity. This actuation capability defines a new phase of the prediction imperative that emphasizes economies of action. This phase represents the completion of the new means of behavior modification, a decisive and necessary evolution of the surveillance capitalist means of production toward a more complex, iterative, and muscular operational system. It is a critical achievement in the race toward guaranteed outcomes. Under surveillance capitalism, the objectives and operations of automated behavioral modification are designed and controlled by companies to meet their own revenue and growth objectives. As one senior engineer told me, "Sensors are used to modify people's behavior just as easily as they modify device behavior. There are many great things we can do with the Internet of Things, like lowering the heat in all the houses on your street so that the transformer is not overloaded, or optimizing an entire industrial operation. But at the individual level, it also means the power to take actions that can override what you are doing or even put you on a path you did not choose." The scientists and engineers whom I interviewed identified three key approaches to economies of action, each one aimed at achieving behavior modification. The first two I call tuning and herding. The third is already familiar as what behavioral psychologists refer to as conditioning. Strategies that produce economies of action vary according to the methods with which these approaches are combined and the salience of each. Tuning occurs in a variety of ways. It may involve subliminal cues designed to subtly shape the flow of behavior at the precise time and place for maximally efficient influence. Another kind of tuning involves what behavioral economists Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein call the nudge, which they define as any aspect of a choice architecture that alters people's behavior in a predictable way. The term choice architecture refers to the ways in which situations are already structured to channel attention and shape action. In some cases, these architectures are intentionally designed to elicit specific behavior, such as a classroom in which all the seats face the teacher, or an online business that requires you to click through many obscure pages in order to opt out of its tracking cookies. The use of this term is another way of saying, in behaviorist language, that social situations are always already thick with tuning interventions, most of which operate outside our awareness. Behavioral economists argue a worldview based on the notion that human mentation is frail and flawed, leading to irrational choices that fail to adequately consider the wider structure of alternatives. Thaler and Sunstein have encouraged governments to actively design nudges that adequately shepherd individual choice-making toward outcomes that align with their interests as perceived by experts. One classic example favored by Thaler and Sunstein is the cafeteria manager who nudges students to healthier food choices by prominently displaying the fruit salad in front of the pudding. Another is the automatic renewal of health insurance policies as a way of protecting individuals who overlook the need for new approvals at the end of each year. Surveillance capitalists adapted many of the highly contestable assumptions of behavioral economists as one cover story with which to legitimate their practical commitment to a unilateral commercial program of behavior modification. The twist here is that nudges are intended to encourage choices that accrue to the architect, not to the individual. The result is data scientists trained on economies of action who regard it as perfectly normal to master the art and science of the digital nudge for the sake of their company's commercial interests. For example, the chief data scientist for a national drugstore chain described how his company designs automatic digital nudges that subtly push people toward the specific behaviors favored by the company. You can make people do things with this technology. Even if it's just 5% of people, you've made 5% of people do an action they otherwise wouldn't have done. So, to some extent, there is an element of the user's loss of self-control. Herding is a second approach that relies on controlling key elements in a person's immediate context. The uncontract is an example of a herding technique. Shutting down a car's engine irreversibly changes the driver's immediate context, herding her out the car door. Herding enables remote orchestration of the human situation, foreclosing action alternatives, and thus moving behavior along a path of heightened probability that approximates certainty. We are learning how to write the music, and then we let the music make them dance, an Internet of Things software developer explains, adding, we can engineer the context around a particular behavior and force change that way. Context-aware data allows us to tie together your emotions, your cognitive functions, your vital signs, etc. We can know if you shouldn't be driving, and we can just shut your car down. We can tell the fridge, hey, lock up because he shouldn't be eating. Or we tell the TV to shut off and make you get some sleep. Or the chair to start shaking because you shouldn't be sitting so long. Or the faucet to turn on because you need to drink more water. Conditioning is a well-known approach to inducing behavior change, primarily associated with the famous Harvard behaviorist B.F. Skinner. He argued that behavior modification should mimic the evolutionary process, in which naturally occurring behaviors are selected for success by environmental conditions. Instead of the earlier, more simplistic model of stimulus-response associated with behaviorists such as Watson and Pavlov, Skinner interpolated a third variable, reinforcement. In his laboratory work with mice and pigeons, Skinner learned how to observe a range of naturally occurring behaviors in the experimental animal, and then reinforce the specific action, or operant, that he wanted the animal to reproduce. Ultimately, he mastered intricate designs or schedules of reinforcement that could reliably shape precise behavioral routines. Skinner called the application of reinforcements to shape specific behaviors operant conditioning. His larger project was known as behavior modification or behavioral engineering, in which behavior is continuously shaped to amplify some actions at the expense of others. In the end, the pigeon learns, for example, to peck a button twice in order to receive a pellet of grain. The mouse learns his way through a complicated maze and back again. Skinner imagined a pervasive technology of behavior that would enable the application of such methods across entire human populations. As the chief data scientist for a much-admired Silicon Valley education company told me, conditioning at scale is essential to the new science of massively engineered human behavior. He believes that smartphones, wearable devices, and the larger assembly of always-on networked nodes allow his company to modify and manage a substantial swath of its users' behavior. As digital signals monitor and track a person's daily activities, the company gradually masters the schedule of reinforcements, rewards, recognition, or praise that can reliably produce the specific user behaviors that the company selects for dominance. The goal of everything we do is to change people's actual behavior at scale. We want to figure out the construction of changing a person's behavior, and then we want to change how lots of people are making their day-to-day decisions. When people use our app, we can capture their behaviors and identify good and bad ones. Then we develop treatments or data pellets that select good behaviors. We can test how actionable our cues are for them and how profitable certain behaviors are for us. Although it is still possible to imagine automated behavioral modification without surveillance capitalism, it is not possible to imagine surveillance capitalism without the marriage of behavior modification and the technological means to automate its application. This marriage is essential to economies of action. For example, one can imagine a fitness tracker, a car, or a refrigerator whose data and operational controls are accessible exclusively to their owners for the purposes of helping them to exercise more often, drive safely, and eat healthily. But as we have already seen in so many domains, the rise of surveillance capitalism has obliterated the idea of the simple feedback loop characteristic of the behavioral value reinvestment cycle. In the end, it's not the devices. It's Max Weber's economic orientation, now determined by surveillance capitalism. The allure of surveillance revenues drives the continuous accumulation of more and more predictive forms of behavioral surplus. The most predictive source of all is behavior that has already been modified to orient toward guaranteed outcomes. The fusion of new digital means of modification and new economic aims produces whole new ranges of techniques for creating and cornering these new forms of surplus. A study called Behavior Change Implemented in Electronic Lifestyle Activity Monitors is illustrative. Researchers from the University of Texas and the University of Central Florida studied 13 such applications, concluding that the monitoring devices contain a wide range of behavior change techniques typically used in clinical behavior interventions. The researchers conclude that behavior change operations are proliferating as a result of their migration to digital devices and internet connectivity. They note that the very possibility of a simple loop designed by and for the consumer seems hopelessly elusive, observing that behavior change apps lend themselves to various types of surveillance, and that official methods of securely and simply transmitting data do not appear to currently exist in these apps. Remember that Google economist Hal Varian extolled the new uses of big data that proceed from ubiquitous computer-mediated transactions. Among these, he included the opportunity for continuous experimentation. Varian noted that Google has its engineering and data science teams consistently running thousands of A-B experiments that rely on randomization and controls to test user reactions to hundreds of variations in page characteristics, from layout to buttons to fonts. Varian endorsed and celebrated this self-authorizing experimental role, warning that all the data in the world can only measure correlation, not causality. Data tell what happened, but not why it happened. In the absence of casual knowledge, even the best predictions are only extrapolations from the past. The result of this conundrum is that the last crucial element in the construction of high-quality prediction products, that is, those that approximate guaranteed outcomes, depends upon casual knowledge. As Varian says, if you really want to understand causality, you have to run experiments. And if you run experiments continuously, you can continuously improve your system. Because the system is intended to produce predictions, continuously improving the system means closing the gap between prediction and observation in order to approximate certainty. In an analog world, such ambitions would be far too expensive to be practical. But Varian observes that, in the realm of the Internet, experimentation can be entirely automated. Varian awards surveillance capitalists the privilege of the experimenter's role, and this is presented as another casual fait accompli. In fact, it reflects the final critical step in surveillance capitalists' radical self-dealing of new rights. In this phase of the prediction imperative, surveillance capitalists declare their right to modify others' behavior for profit according to methods that bypass human awareness, individual decision rights, and the entire complex of self-regulatory processes that we summarize with terms such as autonomy and self-determination. What follows now are two distinct narratives of surveillance capitalists as experimenters who leverage their asymmetries of knowledge to impose their will on the unsuspecting human subjects who are their users. The experimental insights accumulated through their one-way mirrors are critical to constructing, fine-tuning, and exploring the capabilities of each firm's for-profit means of behavioral modification. In Facebook's user experiments and in the augmented reality game Pokemon Go, imagined and incubated at Google, we see the commercial means of behavioral modification evolving before our eyes. Both combine the components of economies of action and the techniques of tuning, herding, and conditioning in startling new ways that expose the Greeks secreted deep in the belly of the Trojan horse. The economic orientation obscured behind the veil of the digital. 2. Facebook writes the music. In 2012, Facebook researchers startled the public with an article provocatively titled, "A 61 Million Person Experiment in Social Influence and Political Mobilization," published in the scientific journal Nature. In this controlled, randomized study, conducted during the run-up to the 2010 U.S. congressional midterm elections, the researchers experimentally manipulated the social and informational content of voting-related messages in the news feeds of nearly 61 million Facebook users, while also establishing a control group. One group was shown a statement at the top of their news feed encouraging the user to vote. It included a link to polling place information, an actionable button reading, "I voted," a counter indicating how many other Facebook users reported voting, and up to 6 profile pictures of the user's Facebook friends who had already clicked the "I voted" button. A second group received the same information, but without the pictures of friends. A third control group did not receive any special message. The results showed that users who received the social message were about 2% more likely to click on the "I voted" button than did those who received the information alone, and 0.26% more likely to click on polling place information. The Facebook experimenters determined that social messaging was an effective means of tuning behavior at scale, because it directly influenced political self-expression, information-seeking, and real-world voting behavior of millions of people. And they concluded that showing familiar faces to users can dramatically improve the effectiveness of a mobilization message. The team calculated that the manipulated social messages sent 60,000 additional voters to the polls in the 2010 midterm elections, as well as another 280,000 who cast votes as a result of a social contagion effect, for a total of 340,000 additional votes. In their concluding remarks, the researchers asserted that, "We show the importance of social influence for affecting behavior change. The results suggest that online messages might influence a variety of offline behaviors, and this has implications for our understanding of the role of online social media in society." The experiment succeeded by producing social cues that suggested or primed users in ways that tuned their real-world behavior toward a specific set of actions determined by the experimenters. In this process of experimentation, economies of action are discovered, honed, and ultimately institutionalized in software programs and their algorithms that function automatically, continuously, ubiquitously, and pervasively to achieve economies of action. Facebook's surplus is aimed at solving one problem: how and when to intervene in the state of play that is your daily life in order to modify your behavior and thus sharply increase the predictability of your actions now, soon, and later. The challenge for surveillance capitalists is to learn how to do this effectively, automatically, and therefore economically, as a former Facebook product manager writes. Experiments are run on every user at some point in their tenure on the site, whether that is seeing different size ad copy, or different marketing messages, or different call-to-action buttons, or having their feeds generated by different ranking algorithms. The fundamental purpose of most people at Facebook working on data is to influence and alter people's moods and behavior. They are doing it all the time to make you like stories more, to click on more ads, to spend more time on the site. This is just how a website works. Everyone does this, and everyone knows that everyone does this. The Facebook Studies publication evoked fierce debate as experts and the wider public finally began to reckon with Facebook's and the other internet companies' unprecedented power to persuade, influence, and ultimately manufacture behavior. Harvard's Jonathan Zittrain, a specialist in internet law, acknowledged that it was now possible to imagine Facebook quietly engineering an election, using means that its users could neither detect nor control. He described the Facebook experiment as a challenge to collective rights that could undermine the right of people as a whole to enjoy the benefits of a democratic process. Public concern failed to destabilize Facebook's self-authorizing practice of behavior modification at scale. Even as the social influence experiment was being debated in 2012, a Facebook data scientist was already collaborating with academic researchers on a new study: experimental evidence of massive-scale emotional contagion through social networks, submitted to the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2013, where it was edited by a well-known Princeton social psychologist, Susan Fiske, and published in June 2014. This time, the experimenters manipulated the extent to which people, N equals 689,003, were exposed to emotional expressions in their newsfeed. The experiment was structured like one of those allegedly benign A-B tests. In this case, one group was exposed to mostly positive messages in their newsfeed, and the other to predominantly negative messages. The idea was to test whether even subliminal exposure to specific emotional content would cause people to change their own posting behavior to reflect that content. It did. Whether or not users felt happier or sadder, the tone of their expression changed to reflect their newsfeed. The experimental results left no doubt that, once again, Facebook's carefully designed, undetectable, and uncontestable subliminal cues reached beyond the screen into the daily lives of hundreds of thousands of naive users, predictably actuating specific qualities of emotional expression through processes that operate outside the awareness of their human targets, just as Stuart McKay had originally prescribed for Galapagos turtles and Canadian elk. Refer to Chapter 7. Emotional states can be transferred to others via emotional contagion, leading people to experience the same emotions without their awareness, the researchers proclaimed. Online messages influence our experience of emotions, which may affect a variety of offline behaviors. The team celebrated its work as some of the first experimental evidence to support the controversial claims that emotions can spread throughout a network. And they reflected on the fact that even their relatively minimal manipulation had a measurable effect, albeit a small one. What Facebook researchers failed to acknowledge in either experiment is that a person's susceptibility to subliminal cues and his or her vulnerability to a contagion effect is largely dependent upon empathy. The ability to understand and share in the mental and emotional state of another person, including feeling another's feelings and being able to take another's point of view, sometimes characterized as affective or cognitive empathy. Psychologists have found that the more a person can project himself or herself into the feelings of another and take the other's perspective, the more likely he or she is to be influenced by subliminal cues, including hypnosis. Empathy orients people toward other people. It allows one to get absorbed in emotional experience and to resonate with others' experiences, including unconsciously mimicking another's facial expressions or body language. Contagious laughing and even contagious yawning are examples of such resonance. Empathy is considered essential to social bonding and emotional attachment, but it can also trigger vicarious anxiety for victims or others who are genuinely distressed. Some psychologists have called empathy a risky strength because it predisposes us to experience others' happiness, but also their pain. The successful tuning evident in both Facebook experiments is the result of the effective exploitation of the natural empathy present in its population of users. The Facebook researchers claimed that the results suggested two inferences. First, in a massive and engaged population such as Facebook users, even small effects can have large aggregated consequences. Second, the authors invited readers to imagine what might be accomplished with more significant manipulations and larger experimental populations, noting the importance of their findings for public health. Once again, public outcry was substantial. If Facebook can tweak emotions and make us vote, what else can it do? The Guardian asked. The Atlantic quoted the study's editor, who had processed the article for publication despite her apparent misgivings. She told the magazine that, as a private company, Facebook did not have to adhere to the legal standards for experimentation required of academic and government researchers. These legal standards are known as the Common Rule. Designed to protect against the abuse of the experimenter's power, these standards must be adhered to by all federally funded research. The Common Rule enforces procedures for informed consent, avoidance of harm, debriefing, and transparency, and it is administered by panels of scientists known as internal review boards, appointed within every research institution. Fisk acknowledged that she had been persuaded by Facebook's argument that the experimental manipulation was an unremarkable extension of the corporation's standard practice of manipulating people's news feeds. As Fisk recounted, they said that Facebook apparently manipulates people's news feeds all the time. Who knows what other research they're doing? In other words, Fisk recognized that the experiment was merely an extension of Facebook's standard practices of behavioral modification, which already flourish without sanction. Facebook data scientist and principal researcher Adam Kramer was deluged with hundreds of media queries, leading him to write on his Facebook page that the corporation really does care about its emotional impact. One of his co-authors, Cornell's Jeffrey Hancock, told the New York Times that he didn't realize that manipulating the news feeds, even modestly, would make some people feel violated. The Wall Street Journal reported that the Facebook Data Science Group had run more than 1,000 experiments since its inception in 2007 and operated with few limits and no internal review board. Writing in The Guardian, psychology professor Chris Chambers summarized that the Facebook study paints a dystopian future in which academic researchers escape ethical restriction by teaming up with private companies to test increasingly dangerous or harmful interventions. A month after the Emotional Contagion Studies publication, the editor-in-chief of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Inder M. Verma, published an editorial expression of concern regarding the Facebook research. After acknowledging the standard defense that Facebook is technically exempt from the Common Rule, Verma added, It is nevertheless a matter of concern that the collection of the data by Facebook may have involved practices that were not fully consistent with the principles of obtaining informed consent and allowing participants to opt out. Among U.S. scholars, University of Maryland law professor James Grimmelman published the most comprehensive argument in favor of holding Facebook and other social media companies accountable to the standards represented by the Common Rule. Corporate research is more likely than academic research to be compromised by serious conflicts of interests, he reasoned, making common experimental standards critical